Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse is here. We have a whole host of content coming your way, including our exclusive interview with Phil Lord and Chris Miller.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 264 of Real Blend, a podcast that won't ever retire. We'll just reload. My name is Sean O'Connell. I'm the managing editor at Cinema Blend. And on this week's show, as if you can't tell from the jersey that I'm wearing, and you have to go to the YouTube channel to understand what that is, it is Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse week. We have a whole host of content coming your way, including an exclusive sit-down conversation with Phil Lord and Chris Miller, talking about all things into and across and a little bit of beyond the Spider-Verse. So let me introduce the boys, because there's a lot to get to. And I will start with Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hello, Kevin. How are you, sir?
Hello, Sean, Jacob, Gabriel. Great to see you guys. And yeah, I'm excited about this week. Phil and Chris are amazing.
It's so good to have them on. Returning guests, by the way. Yep. And the last time they were on, which I'm going to plug, go back and find it. It was for the After Party, their terrific Apple TV show. And we surprised them with a guest. That I won't mention, because in case you're listening to it for the first time, I want you to be surprised by the guest as well, too.
So that's right.
Bill and Chris on the Real Blend podcast talking After Party. Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago is also here as well. You might recognize him from his multiple quotes in the various Across the Spider-Verse trailers that don't annoy me at all.
Our quotes are often touching. What are you talking about?
No, for the most part, like in some of these ones, you get like four out of the four quotes. And Brendan paused it when we were watching one of the NBA games, and he goes, hey, look. And I said, yeah, I know, friend. Yeah.
Did you have like a Spielberg moment? You're like, he didn't get them.
No, I had to be very happy for you getting showcased in those ends.
I'm looking at your jersey, and yes. I'm thinking back to like all of the Spider-Man and Marvel and DC t-shirts and everything you own. And do you think like Michelle ever does the laundry and just sighs deeply?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yes, 100%. I told you when we were at the New Beverly for the book signing, and everybody was showing up for Spider-Man 2, all the fans were coming in with Spider-Man t-shirts and gear, and I was commenting on everyone's shirts because I see a lot of new ones, and Michelle looks around and she goes, it just looks like your closet in here.
And she didn't mean that in a good way.
No, she didn't. No, I wear an abundance of, this is like my bit though, right? Like I've committed to the bit of wearing superhero.
How many Spider-Man shirts do you think you own?
Oh my God. Okay, are there more Spider-Man shirts or more Spider-Man movies?
Shirts. Oh, shirts. Oh, without a question. Yeah, shirts. I probably have like 10, but I've recycled a bunch over the years. I get them and I wear them, and then they turn into like pajama shirts because they wear out, they stretch out and thing. And then they just have to be removed.
There's a tear of Spider-Man.
Gabe Kovach is sitting in the producer's chair as well, too. Hello, Gabriel. How are you, sir?
I am fantastic. I am seeing the movie that we're talking all about this week and a lot next week, as folks will find out in a number of hours. So I couldn't be more excited.
And he's going to take his headphones out in case we get into specific details, but we won't. We're going to dance around
spoilers. Spoiler free this week.
Yes, we are. Including our convo with Phil and Chris, which you guys can listen to in full. So if you're watching us on YouTube, first off, hello there. Good to see you guys. We really appreciate you guys coming to the channel to watch the show on Fridays usually, or throughout the weekend. And if you guys want to wait until after you've seen Spider-Verse this time, we totally understand. If you're joining us for the very first time, head down, give us a like and a subscribe. Tell friends about the channel. This is a really fun way to spread the word of Real Blend. And of course, if you don't want to watch
spread
the video format
of Real Blend.
And also, yeah, I keep posting those photos on Fridays when you guys watch it on your televisions.
Oh, that's
those.
Fun.
Yeah, that's always a lot of fun when people
that
are
the best.
Watching the show. And our giant heads are on their TV screens. Of course, we're available everywhere you get your podcast needs met. I want to let you guys know we do have some exciting news, some updates for the show that if you tune in every week to listen to Real Blend on the regular, you are going to want to stay tuned until the very end of the show to hear more about these updates. We're going to go through the normal bits of the show, and then we'll give you guys that update about Real Blend in a little while. You'll be excited. Wait,
is this the one where we're announcing Christopher Nolan's taking over as a co-host?
He's just him by himself.
Jumped the gun.
It's actually for the rest of the year. It's just him and Greta Gerwig doing a movie podcast on our feeds. That's it.
I would watch.
I'd listen to
and
that.
Listen. Yeah,
I would
listen.
I really would gladly listen. Fast and Furious rankings are.
Oh, that's where we're episode 1.
They do
it's just all S's.
Moderated by Tarantino.
Until those two come around for their show, you get us talking to Phil Lord and Chris Miller about all things Across the Spider-Verse. This week's interview, yes, Jake.
Have we done a Spider-Man tier list?
I don't think we've done a specific Spider-Man tier list, though. I think we've only done Spider-Man in the MCU tier list.
Yeah,
I think Batman's the only character that we've done.
Really? That doesn't seem
I'll
right.
go back and double check, but I don't know that we've done Spider-Man solo.
I need to go back and listen to the Batman one. I'm sitting here thinking, when did we do Batman?
Batman one's good. We did that for the Batman.
There are 3 negative Across the Spider-Verse reviews at this moment. Like, can you imagine sitting down for that movie and coming out of it and being like, didn't work for me.
I'll give it a green splat.
No idea.
All right. Anyway, let's get to the guys who are semi-responsible for Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, in addition to an enormous creative team. But at the head of that snake is Phil Lord and Chris Miller, and they are joining us on the Real Blend podcast. They said they wanted to be watching it with me in that message.
Yeah, I thought it was for me. Okay.
It was private for each. Guys, don't share our private conversations with one another.
Well, they specifically called me, and they're like, hey, we have a message coming up, and you're going to think it's for other people, but it's for you.
It's actually secretly just for you.
Yeah. Guys, we have literally not stopped talking about this movie since we saw it. It is an absolute masterpiece that has floored all of us.
That's so kind of you to say.
Love to hear that.
We don't even know what words to use. Like, we were texting after the movie was over, and I was like, I don't even know how to explain what I just watched, because I was telling the guys, it's like a simultaneous thing where you're immersed in the story so much, but my brain allowed me to also step back and think about what I was visually experiencing, but I never lost touch with the story at the same time. So it was almost as if I was like, I got to think about it in 2 ways at the same time. It was unbelievable. So congratulations to you guys.
Thank you very much. You know,
a friend of mine told me that she has already picked out the weed that she will be smoking before she goes in. And that concerns me a little bit, but she seems to know what she's doing.
Well, we had a professor in college who was definitely a child of the 60s, our animation professor. And I remember he told us once that we didn't need to smoke weed because you guys are already there.
That's the ultimate compliment.
That's their secret. They're just high all the time. That's like,
we don't smoke pot, and it's, I think, I don't know, because I don't know what it would do.
It ends up making you very normal.
Yeah.
All right. So we got to start. There are so many amazing ways that Across the Spider-Verse ties into the Spider-Verse. And they can't be coincidences, the way that certain things lay out. And I won't get into specifics, you know, I'll let people discover them for themselves, but I want to know how much of Across you guys knew when you were doing Into, and what's one thing that you wish you would put in the first film that might have helped the next two?
Wow.
Oh, gosh.
There were a couple of things. Well, obviously, we, you know, there's the beat at the end of the first movie.
Right. We had to do a bit of retconning.
There was a little bit of retconning on that, as far as, you know, he's older now, and it was, you know, in the first movie, it was still his younger design.
I tried to talk Chris into going back into the first film and revising the final shot to make Miles look older.
Oh, that's funny.
And also, it's unclear in that final shot, it's Miles dropping into his bed. It's unclear whether he's in his dorm room or in his parents' house. It was his bed from the dorm room, so we had to kind of like retcon it into his parents' apartment.
We also did a big redesign on Captain George Stacy, who appears very briefly in the first movie, but doesn't look like the way the character that's voiced by Shea Whigham is in this movie.
I would have given Dr. Jonathan Owen a cool beard and hairstyle.
Yes. back in his bagel. Brief cameo.
That really kind of. You see his original look in a photograph in his apartment.
Is it a coincidence that he gets hit with one of the only breakfast foods that has a hole in the middle of it?
That's definitely not a coincidence. That is by design.
Yes.
Amazing. I never thought about that.
Just on Sean's question, how much of a cross did you know going into?
Very little, perfectly honest. We knew that Miguel was going to be the way to get Miles to go. We were calling it actually into the Spider-Verse because Miles didn't really go into the Spider-Verse in the first movie. That was our sort of temp working title for it.
And Dave Callahan had done a lot of work on the story.
Yes.
And things that are some of which are going to wind up in the next picture at the third film in the trilogy. But Dave did a lot of work thinking about the implications of traveling to other places.
And so there was a little bit that we were able to sort of make sure that we were not stepping on in the original movie. But in all honesty, so much of it came after it was finished.
Guys, I feel like today is the perfect day to ask the question I'm going to ask, because 43 years ago today, a movie called The Empire Strikes Back hit theaters. And I feel like any time we ever get the second installment of a series and it's a little bit darker and it ends in such a way that you're screaming at the screen because you're ready for the next one, people automatically go, oh, this is the Empire Strikes Back of this series. I'm sort of curious how much you guys sort of think about that comparison anytime there's sort of a darker second film. As Star Wars fans, do you guys think of this as sort of your Empire Strikes Back? And I guess just as film fans, is that just sort of a lazy thing that we say anytime there's a sort of a darker second film where we call it, you know, this is the Empire Strikes Back of this series?
It's hard to sort of, you know, call yourself an Empire Strikes Back.
That's a little bit like calling your own home run,
right? Because that's it's an excellent film. That said, I think there is naturally a thing that happens in sequels where the character is maturing, the protagonist maturing, as the film has to mature with it, and if it stays, it has to get more sophisticated by its nature, or it feels unsatisfying, and so I think. The film has to grow up to a certain degree.
And so even the lighting in this film, has a kind of more sophisticated sheen. The thing about Empire, one of the things that you love is that, it's like it's directed by Irving Kirshner. It has a kind of like art house like veneer to it, right? Like the lighting, like people walk out of light and into shadow and back into light. Like they're not just being followed around by studio lighting all the time. So at the granular level, Empire has is reaching for a kind of richness that we were also hoping to accomplish.
And what's interesting is that there was the ending of Empire, the sort of hopeful part where Luke gets his new hand and they all stare out into the future with a bit of hope, was a reshoot that they did after they put the film together. And we went through a similar cycle of like trying to figure out what the right balance of hopefulness and excitement for and for the next film without giving away too much about where it was headed.
Because even though the film ends with some unfinished business, it's ultimately a movie about people coming together. And so the film ends, in a way that you watch the formation of, a band.
Right. And you're also, this film is, it is the middle of a trilogy, but it has to feel like its own film. Each character has to have a full arc, and Miles starts in one place emotionally and ends in a totally different place. His parents grow. Gwen and her dad have a relationship that grows. Peter B. grows, and everybody starts the movie one place and ends another. So it has a beginning, middle, and end, and it's its own thing. It's just there's a little bit of unfinished business left that needs to get resolved in the final film.
Just a little.
I'm curious from this, from a marketing perspective, and this is something that we were all texting about as well. So originally this was going to be like a part one, part two, correct? That was kind of like the idea of if I had that correct. And one of the things I find interesting is now with the title not having part one in it and then saying to be continued. I'm just curious from a marketing perspective for general audiences, like going into the movie, will they know they're watching like a half of the story
leading into it. We figured that it actually isn't a half of the story. It is a whole story. And as we were putting it together, the film, we were realizing we were trying to jam two movies into one movie. And we realized that this was its own movie that has, as I said, a beginning, middle, and end. And so it felt clearer to say, like, this is the second film of a trilogy than to be like, oh, this is a movie that's split in half. Because at the end of the day, it really wasn't. So
part of our job now is to help people understand that this is the middle film of a trilogy and that there's more to come. So that, like, they don't go, wait a minute.
At the end. But they also realize that they're not getting just, like, an arbitrary cut point of...
And we've seen people respond to the end of this film, and it's an expression of their engagement, you know, that they're so locked in to this story that they don't want it to end.
That's how I felt. I could have watched 2.5 more hours. That's what I was saying. Like, when it ended, I'm like, I need more of it now. Like, it was like, that's how I felt.
Right. And so, listen, there is more to come. And what we hope for is that there will be a roadshow version that has just an epic film with an intermission.
Well, my reaction as soon as it ended was re-rack that film. I need to watch it again immediately. Yeah. I'm not going anywhere. I'm sitting right here. And part of it is because with everything that's happening on the screen, I feel like I processed, I'll say 70% of it.
That's good.
So what's a joke that you guys are so proud of that you're afraid people might miss because of the amount of stuff that's going on?
There's so much happening.
There's literally a scene full of jokes that you are supposed to miss.
Oh, really?
When Miles walks in and...
Oh, everyone, they all quip. There's a room full of spider people quipping about the spot, and you see all of the... the jokes that they're all saying on top of each other.
Right.
But there's a lot. It's hard to. Every scene has some little thing happening in the background. You know, there's the creepy smiley guy from the first movie is in this movie also briefly. Everybody. You know, it's a massive team, and everybody wanted to add something to it, and so there's just a level of richness that really is rewarded by repeat viewing in the theater on the big screen.
There's also if you watch Taron Killam's character,
Web Slinger.
Yeah. Pat O'Hara. Right. Mm-hmm. there's a moment where he's in like the background of a shot falling off of his chair when Miles comes through. And it's so funny. But I only caught it like the fifth time I watched the shot.
And it's now because of this movie that I know that ATM machine that literally blew my mind. I've been saying ATM machine all my life. And I'm like, why am I saying the extra M? It already means machine. And then chai tea and then non bread. I'm like, what am I doing?
That's absolutely all Chris Miller's work.
That was brilliant. That literally, every time I see an ATM machine now, I will never forget that line. From the
it
movie.
Was your you, note. You, right.
Yeah, I was like, yeah. Well, originally, when Miles was, the spot was like, "Where's the ATM machine?" I was like, you know, he's a scientist. I don't know that he would say he would be smart enough to know that the M is for machine. And then we were like, okay, let's have it. Miles make fun of him for it.
Yeah.
Can you guys reveal one Jeopardy category from the night that Miles co-hosted?
Yes, I wrote them. Swinging in the rain. Hold on. That was like the.
We love a good pun. We
swinging
love
in the rain.
Arachnidiums. I'm trying to remember all of them, but
It's amazing. Thank you.
So I don't want to bring the mood of the room down, but one of the things I texted the guys after we saw this was like, damn, I wish Stan Lee could have seen this movie. There's so many aspects of this movie that I have a framed photo with him in my apartment, like 8 feet that way. So I'm a big Stan Lee fan. What is an aspect of this film that you guys most wish that you could have put in front of him for him to see? And I know he's all over Into the Spider-Verse. Is he in Across the Spider-Verse at all?
You know, we made a choice that it felt a bit macabre.
Right. Or exploitive or
and
something.
And exploitive to, like, put someone in a movie when they could no longer offer permission. So that was just our choice. We every once in a while second-guessed it just because we suspected that he would have been delighted. you know, but in any case, you know, he is all over the movie in many ways. The thing that's extraordinary is that what he and Steve Ditko came up with is so salient and resonant that it has replicated itself. It's such a powerful idea that one of these heroes is just as scared and vulnerable and clumsy and silly as any of us are, that it's resilient enough to drive the storylines of 1,000 different spider people, right? And so the variations on it, the variations on a theme are so, I don't know, to me that's so interesting. You know, there's a reason the movie starts with a Jeff Koons art exhibit. And it's because, you know, when we were deciding whether to do the first film, you know, we were at the Whitney, which was having a Jeff Koons retrospective. And one of the things that Jeff does is he'll take, you know, a bust of Louis XIV and, like, remake it and cast it in chrome. Right. And in so doing, like, creates a new work of art that is referencing the earlier one and including it, but also chopping and screwing it. And that's when we thought, gosh, we can do that with a movie. We could do that with this Spider-Man story. So that's our objective, is to take the work that Stan and Steve did and have it be part of this work also.
You know, one of the things I love about this film is you're constantly reminded that he's just a teenager. And at the end of the day, there's so much going on and so much insanity. But then you have these grounded reminders, literally, where he's grounded because of something that he did. But also, like, there's a moment that he has with his mom, which I think was part of the first trailer, where she talks about how, like, the boy, you know, please take care of this boy as he goes out into the world. It's one of the most brilliant emotional sequences I've seen. Just the eyes in that scene are insane. But I want to ask each of you, like, growing up, do you remember a story about being grounded for something you did? Kind of like Miles was. Is there something that comes to mind where you go, oh yeah, I got grounded for this, or I did that, or I got time out or punishment?
I was grounded for a month.
Oh, yeah?
Because I was a very good kid, but everybody was going to Mitch Vento's New Year's Eve party, and Mitch was a returning college student who was throwing a party with open containers, and my parents had gotten a letter from the school saying, watch out this New Year's Eve, like, don't let your kids go to open source parties. So they said, you can't go. And so I lied and said I was going to see a movie with my cousin. And when she got in the car, I said, she's like, we're not going to the movies, are we? I said, no, we're going to Mitch Vento's party. And anyway, I'm the worst liar that there is. So the next day, my parents said, we are so proud of you for, you know, following the rules and foregoing Mitch Vento's party. And then I erupted in laughter and the cereal came out of my nose. And so that night they were like, you lying sack. You're grounded for a month.
Chris, what about you?
I had a very similar but not quite as interesting version of that same story where I was invited to a party, and the only other kid in my grade that was invited to the party was a person that I barely knew, and I told my parents that I needed a ride to his house because we were going to hang out together, and they're like, why are you hanging out with this guy with Nassim Kemis? And I was like, we're friends now.
He was so cool. You're like, you're punching above your weight. You're
like, what is this?
Chris,
what is
there's
this?
No way.
What's happening here? And I got totally busted, and I didn't even get to go to the party. I got busted before even getting to the party.
That's a shame.
But I will say, it's a lot like, you know, this movie is a feels like mild, like Gwen got invited to the party, and he wants to be invited too.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
He sort of sneaks out. It goes to the party, and then it doesn't go well.
Do you want to know how Mitch Vento's party was?
How was it?
It was fine.
There you go.
Was it worth the month grounding?
It was definitely not. The thing that was interesting is, like, I was only included because I agreed to be the designated driver for other, like, I was punching above my weight with the other people that were going. And I just remember, like, driving my, like, gigantic, you know, old Oldsmobile that my hand me down from my mother through a, in, it was Florida. So we have drive-throughs where you can buy alcohol. And I was like, this is bad. but it is like that, like Chris came up with the original premise of this movie, which is what if there was an awesome party and Gwen got invited and Miles didn't? Yeah. What would it do?
That's cool. Cool.
Yeah. The Spider versus Joe Vento's party.
Mitch Vento's party.
Everyone knows Mitch Vento.
And I'm glad Mitch Vento is getting
Where is Mitch Vento
he's back
now?
Yeah, he's back from Syracuse. It's going to be amazing.
Okay, so I am hung up on the title of Beyond the Spider-Verse. And knowing that you guys, you know, can't tell us anything and likely will deflect, I'm just curious what your thoughts are, because the animation in this is so genius. And it's staggering how good it is. But I think Beyond, and I think of a mix of live action and animation, a sort of Who Framed Miles Morales type thing. Does that intrigue you guys at all? Or do you think that this is an animated franchise that should stay animated because of the creativity it provides?
Well, I think at its core, you know, what's really special about this version of a multiverse is a thing that can't be done in live action, which is that each world is it rendered in a completely different art style and different animation style. And you can feel the hand of a different artist and get immersed in that inside of a different painting in each universe. And so that is what I think this film can do that no other multiverse film can do. And I think that is at the core of what makes this thing special. And I think I don't think we have any interest in losing that. That said, anything is possible in the multiverse, and that's part of the fun of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's well put.
I can see the wheels turning as you're trying to figure out what not to tell us.
Well, I would only look. I mean, for one thing, like I'm not sure there's, you know, obviously we work in both mediums and we're not particularly, we don't really distinguish between the two of them in terms of what we put on the page, right? And so I'd say that the other thing that's kind of interesting apart from that is that there is a known canon, right, that's expressed in this movie of like every known spider, but presumably there is the unknown. and I think that's one of the intellectual ideas underpinning where we're headed.
Ooh. All right. Get here now, March.
Guys, I heard a rumor, and I want to say John Mulaney told this story on a late night show, and I think it was in the IMDb trivia for Into the Spider-Verse, that he was given permission to, when recording Spider-Pig, to just go balls to the wall and just go nuts and do it however he wanted to do it. And for a long time, he recorded a lot of his lines as sort of an R-rated Spider-Pig before finally being told, John, this is a PG film. I'm sort of curious, what are some of the more insane things that somewhere in the Sony vault you have audio recordings of Spider-Pig saying?
Oh.
I mean, we should dig some of that stuff up because I think that would be pretty fun, a little
yeah.
surprise.
There's a couple of four-letter words, I think.
For sure.
Yeah.
I don't remember any of the specifics of what it was, but I just remember laughing a lot and thinking, so little of this is usable.
But you know, like when you're recording an actor, it's certainly somebody who's as like creative and funny as John, like you're panning for gold, right? There's going to be a lot of like silt. You know what I mean? It's not a high yield enterprise. It's like you're trying to find that one surprising thing that nobody would have expected.
What was the line that wasn't R-rated, but that was, it sort of killed the mood, though, but it was in the movie for a long time when everyone was saying about how they lost their uncle or their dad, and he said...
He talked about how he had a relative that had been turned into bacon.
They got electrocuted, right?
And he smelled delicious.
Yeah, that's right. He got electrocuted.
His friend got electrocuted, his uncle, and he got electrocuted, and he smelled so delicious. Right.
And it was a great joke, but everyone was like, I really wanted to keep it in, but everyone was like, it's killing the
What's
mood,
weird obviously. Is that, like, that, funny enough, that character didn't, like, the Spider-Ham, like, was... His like scores were a little bit depressed for a character that was getting a lot of laughs. He was the audience really wanted from him is to be like real for
a moment
just
of
one
sincerity.
Moment.
Yes. And he was at that moment. He ended up being like saying, you know, sometimes
you can't always save everybody. That was added because he needed to be not just like a punchline.
Instead of the fact that his uncle smelled delicious and he was like...
Isn't the last shot of him in Into the Spider-Verse, isn't it him eating a hot dog?
Yes.
It is.
It is. But in his world, hot dogs are made from humans. So it's not weird.
Fair enough.
I want to mention some other things because I throughout all the insanity and the incredible visuals and the way you guys balance score and soundtrack is so perfect, because I feel like at the end of the day, when you have films that are soundtrack heavy and then you have films that are score heavy, but then when you mix them both together and you have them beautifully working together as you do in this film, it's incredible. But there was a line that really struck me when Miles says to his father, he goes, men of your generation ignore their mental health too long.
That's a Phil Lord line right there.
In all honesty, like as somebody who's dealt with depression and anxiety and not being able to speak about mental health for a long time, and then now it's got a lot more destigmatized and people have more conversations about it, it was a really great line just to have a kid say it to his father, because now I talk to my dad about mental health a lot more than I did as a kid. So you guys are laughing, but I'm genuinely curious. Like, does that line mean something to both of you? Like, and putting the mental health aspect in there, it's just a line that struck me. I loved that line.
Well, there's a handful of things in the movie. My mother is a therapist. She's a PhD marriage and family therapist. And so there's a few kind of shout outs to mom. And I can't remember where this came from, but we were just like punching up the scene, I think.
No, I remember you pitched that line and
but it wasn't to serve any goal other than to get a laugh, right? But it really resonated, and I was really surprised at how much the audience enjoyed it. And I do think there is a generational difference in how people think about their mental health, and you know, Chris and I are starting to get on in years. But there we have, you know, that are the younger people that work with us and work at our company, like have just speak about these issues in a much more fluid and well-educated way.
Yeah, there's just like so much less bias against, you know, getting help. And there's so much less of a stigma than there used to be. And it's getting a lot better.
And, you know, at the end of the film, Peter is, you know, asleep, right? Mm-hmm. And he's reading a book.
Right, a parenting book that I have in my office.
And that I just texted my mom and said, if we were going to leave behind an Easter egg, a book that if people picked it up and read it, it would help them. Right?
Wow.
Give me a list, right?
Yeah, it's how to talk how so kids will listen and listen how...
So kids will talk. And it,
oh, really?
Yes, and so we came up, we had a list of like 3 or 4 books. And we send it to the art department to mock them up. And like, well, we picked this one because it looked the best. And it turned out to be really thematic because throughout the movie, people are asking each other to listen. Yes. Right. Like 4 or 5 different times. So it felt like a miracle of purpose.
Right. And it's all about parenting and the developing relationships between children and parents and how they both need to evolve together and grow up together.
Right. And also like about leadership, right? that like Miguel is leading this big group, and some of that leadership means like, you know, leadership used to mean laying down the law, right? But, you know, but when like one of the things we've discovered as filmmakers is that filmmaking is really about listening. It's not about telling. And it means you watch a movie and you listen to the movie with your body. You listen mm-hmm. to the crew members. You're not, if you want to direct or produce a film because you like being in charge, definitely get another job.
This is such a collaborative meeting. I'll tell you a quick story about that, which is that, you know, in an early version of the movie, with Pavitra's talk up was very different. And a number of Indian-American...
Indian-Canadian
animators wrote us an email saying, like, we think Pav can be better and more interesting.
Just cooler.
And cooler. And we had a Zoom with them and, like, okay, tell us what you think. I mean, obviously, you know, it would be great to know, like, how we can make him better. And they sort of... It laid out how they wanted him to be cooler, basically. And so we got together a group of Indian and Indian American writers for a round table. And we're like, how can we make this guy more aspirational, more like a real like kid in Bombay today? And out of that came a whole different version of his intro and opening. And he became so much better, and everyone was so much happier. And the fact that you can like listen to your teammates and help make something better and more authentic and more interesting and more fun. And he became a real favorite.
It transformed the sequence. So the thing that like you could see that email as a speed bump, right? That's just sort of like an obstacle, or you can see it as an opportunity for the movie to get better. Right. It really did, like, it turned a sequence that people enjoyed into a sequence that people loved. And not just Indian people, but everyone. That's the thing about, you know, we're getting a bit off topic. But the thing about, like, inclusivity is that it is good for the audience. It's good for the film. It makes the movie more entertaining.
For everyone.
Right? For everyone. Right. And that's, we often say that, like, people make the punitive case for, like, DEI. Like, they need to make the affirmative case, which is, like, how much better everything gets.
Right, exactly. Well, and it's an incredible credit to both of you guys that's your creative process, is that you always are.
Thank you for sharing that. It's cool to hear that.
Yeah. And we are completely out of time, but just like your movie, we wish it could have gone another 2 more hours.
You guys really have a special film.
Plenty to discuss.
Yeah. Oh, we're very grateful that you feel that way.
And thank you.
It's truly remarkable. Whenever we don't like a movie, we just sort of end the interview and go on with our day. So we can absolutely be saying these things.
Game changing. Like I will remember seeing this movie for the first time ever, always. I wish I could watch it again for the first time, like Sean said.
We will neuralize you
after I saw it.
What did you say?
I asked after I saw it in theaters. I asked for a link and was told no. because I just want to watch it again. I really want to see it again and be able to like pause it and look at things.
Yeah. Well, congrats to you guys.
Thank you very, very much, guys. We really appreciate it. We love all of your guys' work.
We want to thank Phil Lord and Chris Miller and, of course, our good friends at Sony for hooking those guys up onto the show. Always love having them on. Hopefully they'll be return guests, especially as we get closer to Beyond. To let you guys know that we're going to continue all the Across the Spider-Verse love next week when we have the three directors who are responsible for the show. They'll be on the main show Friday, but we also booked a very special guest in composer Daniel Pemberton, who did the music for both Into and Across the Spider-Verse. And this is one of those conversations where when he's in the middle of his first answer, I texted the Real Blend text thread and I was like, oh, he's a genius. I didn't realize exactly.
Okay, is that why you sent that? Because I wasn't part of the interview. I thought you were like looking in the mirror.
Dude, and just his first answer, it goes, his answer wraps, I don't even remember who he was talking about, but it wraps around the concept of like film composition in a way that I was just like, whoa, okay, hold on. We got to really step up our game because this guy is really great.
And that, wherever you got this podcast that you're listening to right now or watching, that'll be dropping on Wednesday.
All right, so let's get into some box office predictions. We have not done this in a while because there hasn't really been a major movie that is going to theoretically test the type of records that animated films hold, that Spider-Man films hold. And we're seeing some wild ranges in terms of different outlets calling what they think Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse is going to earn. Initially, when we started doing prep for this week's episode, we had seen like 80 million as the opening projected weekend. Now, via Box Office Pro, they're putting the opening weekend range anywhere between 95 million and 130 million. So,
and right as we're recording this, a couple of other tweets had just come out. I texted it to you guys in the group.
Did you say 115?
Yeah, a little bit more of a specific. So this is from Discussing Film. Now they're putting an exact number versus like the range, which is an estimate of $115 million in its domestic opening. Now, here's why that's interesting. As you guys know, the original opening of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse was $35 million domestically.
That's what I was just looking up. Is that what they put? $35 million?
Yeah, wow. So this would be, according to Discussing Film, this would be a 70% increase. Now, we often talk about box office a lot on this show in terms of worldwide versus domestic.
Sure.
And, you know, a lot of stories that come out about box office use one or the other to, you know, promote how well their film did. A great example recently was Fast and Furious and Little Mermaid. Little Mermaid did really well domestically, didn't have the massive global opening like a Fast and Furious film did. So the numbers for that box office were heavily domestic in terms of the storytelling about how well Little Mermaid did. Fast and Furious, on the other hand, is a movie that does really well internationally, decent domestically. But when you say Fast and Furious made $512 million in its first 2 weeks or whatever you would say, that's a global number. This number is completely domestic. We're talking about.
But I also think at the same time that Spider-Man Across the, especially the specifically across the Spider-Verse ones, is a global play.
I know. I'm not saying Spider-Man isn't. Spider-Man definitely is a global. Now, what's interesting? So if you look at the numbers, now this is where it gets interesting. You either have movies that are really huge globally and they're heavy international or heavy domestic, like I just gave with the example of Little Mermaid and Fast. Spider-Verse was interesting. So Into the Spider-Verse did 190 domestically, 194 international, basically identical. So 384 worldwide. So to your point, Spider-Man obviously has a global and a large domestic audience. The number that we're talking about, the 115 opening up and the original opening up to 35, that's completely domestic. So this the worldwide on this could be,
well,
I don't know, 250, 300. I have no idea.
It could be. And I also feel with the first one, with Into the Spider-Verse, it's a movie that more people discovered. I mean, a lot of people saw it in theaters, obviously.
Later.
Those are huge
Netflix
numbers. I think more people discovered it after the fact. I think they might have felt like I don't really necessarily need to see another Spider-Man movie at this point. It was coming off of like Tom Holland being at his height. You know, he was in the Avengers movies. He had his own movies. And I'm not quite sure people felt the need, despite the positive reviews, of being like, I'm not going to go see an animated Spider-Man movie.
I mean, I think people just didn't really know what to make of an animated Spider-Man movie. You know, like, especially because I feel like a lot of people grew up with a lot of the animated superheroes being available on, you know, every Saturday morning on TV or, you know, like Mask of the Phantasm, the Batman film, just going straight to VHS. So the idea that something I think for so many years was kind of just handed to a generation, superheroes via animation.
Sure.
Now the idea of, wait, it's going to theaters. And for a lot of people, I think they had to get over the fact that it wasn't a cash grab and it was more an actual work of art with an incredible story to tell.
Sure.
And I think maybe the first watershed moment where a lot of people really started taking it seriously was when it won the Oscar.
I think that
being a watershed moment. And then, like you said, my dad discovered it on. Now, I'll never forget my dad. I think I want to say I was like home for Christmas or something. And my dad coming out going, have you seen like the animated Spider-Man movie? And I was like, yes, Dad. Yes, I have. But, you know, but that is fun, though. Like people sort of discovering this thing that makes him realize, oh, this is something
special. I
want
to watch that movie with Keith so bad. Can I just sit down and rewatch it with him at some point, please?
Look how many Spider-Men there are.
So just because you mentioned the worldwide, I thought that was a curious question, Kevin. In China, it's opening up the same day. In China, the first Spider-Verse film opened to 25.8 million.
Wow.
And eventually made 62 total. So if it was within 10 million of domestic, I'm curious how much of an increase they're going to see there. If at all, I mean, it's a different market, but.
And what's interesting about that
could be a massive worldwide.
Oh, it's going to be huge. Well, I mean, again, that's the crazy thing. So to Sean's point and to Jake's point, I think what happened with Spider-Verse Into the Spider-Verse was it had a you know, a rather successful run theatrically. But like you said, I think when it hit Netflix, that's when I started hearing people talk about it more because it was more accessible. But going to the global debate that I was talking about a second ago, in terms of like looking at Fast X, for example, Fast X has made $113 million domestically, $406 million internationally.
Damn.
So what you're seeing there is
in two weeks.
That's 2 weeks.
Jeez.
So that's interesting in itself, because then if you look at Little Mermaid, I'm looking that up now. Little Mermaid had an interesting way because it was a little heavier. Little Mermaid's the opposite, not as gigantic, but 118 domestic as of right now, 78 international. But then when you look at the Spider-Verse numbers, it seems like it's about even as Gabe is saying, at least with the first one. So if you're seeing a 70% jump from the first Spider-Verse film to the second domestically,
yeah,
it's going to be equal all to right, so, or more than it's probably. I mean, Gabe, is $300 million that
for the
far
opening?
Off?
That seems doable to me because it looks like it's coming to pretty much every major market.
Huge.
So let me ask.
Same day.
Does it hit a billion?
No. I think.
What do you mean so quick to say no?
No, I think. Okay,
no
so
way home.
I don't think you're gonna get the families in the way that Mario did, and you're not gonna get the. As great as, look, we'll talk about reviews later, but as great as the movie is, you're not going to get the like monumental moment in cinema that gets out the $1 billion audiences like No Way Home did.
Also,
I understand what you're saying, but let me push back on one thing. You have a generation of kids who have been watching that first movie for 5 years. 5 years since Into the Spider-Verse came out.
Okay, I
mentioned this when I think I mentioned this on the show because Michelle's in elementary education. And the kids at her school, their Spider-Man is Miles Morales,
which is super cool.
It's amazing. And it's been a steady stream of that movie being replayed over and over again and then getting them into the comics, you know, and reading more about Miles and truly anticipating the next Miles Morales movie, you know, versus we're going to introduce you to this new character, you know. So I think you may get more families than you think. But
here's why I don't think it. I mean, so a couple things to answer the question of will it reach a billion? You look at the market, for example, right now. And again, I'm not comparing this to Guardians of the Galaxy 3, but Guardians of the Galaxy 3 right now open May 3rd. We're almost a month into release. It's 743 million right now.
I didn't think it was going to get that. That's a huge hit for Marvel.
Huge, but it's not. I think it doesn't pass 800, right? So, you know, we'll see on that.
The days of Marvel easily hitting a billion are over,
right? But the question now then becomes: if you look at the June 23 movie releases, so right now, so as of today, so we have June 2nd.
Spider-Verse has 2 weeks.
This is what I was about to say. All right, so basically, okay, right now, Little Mermaid's probably going to drop extremely this weekend, I would imagine, just because I think it was heavily front loaded. I think it'll still make a lot of money this weekend, but I don't think, you know, if it was 100.
It's the same audience, too. It's the family audience who are going to go into Spider-Verse instead.
I think Spider-Verse takes a lot of that audience. Then you have the following weekend, which is
Transformers.
That's interesting. Okay, I don't think that puts a huge dent in it, but let's think about that for a second. Following week is The Flash.
Yep.
Right? June 16th.
I think then that cuts into it.
That definitely cuts into it. And then the week after The Flash, you have Secret Invasion, which is a series. No Hard Feelings. Actually, looking at this release date, because once you get into July, then you start getting into like the, you know, into Indy and Barbie and Oppenheimer, but that's later in July.
And it's older movies, older skewing movies.
I mean, it's basically July.
Oh, yeah.
It's June 30th.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I'm not sure.
I want to use that to transition into our next topic because Kevin's mentioning a ton of blockbusters, and we were having this conversation about these movies all stacking up on top of each other now, all of a sudden, and primarily the premium formats. I did see some people complaining on my Twitter feed about they have to rush out and see Spider-Verse in IMAX or in 4DX this week because by next week it's going to be gone. Like Transformers, I think, has negotiated IMAX
for next week. And then the following is Flash, and Flash will be in IMAX until Indiana Jones gets there. And then, you know, Indy gets IMAX until Mission, and then Mission gets it until Oppenheimer. Like, if you want to see it in the premium format, and truly, I think a movie like Across the Spider-Verse deserves to be seen in the IMAX format. I honestly think with Flash as well, too. Flash is a movie you're going to want to see in the IMAX format. You have such a limited amount of time when you need to get to these movies to see them that way. And we were talking specifically about Mission being the one that feels like it's being sandwiched in a really difficult spot because it has Oppenheimer right behind it. And Nolan, from what I understand, has a 3-week exclusivity, you know, when he hits, because he has such a great deal with IMAX. So Mission's theoretically going to get 1 week in IMAX before it has to move to regular screens. And that's a significant, because I bought IMAX tickets for Across the Spider-Verse for my family, and I don't buy a lot of movie tickets because I'm lucky enough to be able to get to go to screenings. And I was like, hot damn, this is a lot of money to pay for IMAX tickets. But it's, that counts a lot to the box office. So I don't, this seems like a weird problem that Hollywood wanted to stockpile all of their movies in June and July, because August seems thin to me.
Well, so, I mean, honestly, doesn't May seem kind of thin? Like, what, we had Guardians, Fast, and Little Mermaid.
Yeah.
Just basically in May. And then all of a sudden, within like a 12 to 14 day period, you have Indy, Mission, Barbie, and Oppenheimer. Like, did no one, I mean, did everyone think that the other studio was going to blink?
I guess. Yeah, I guess. I'm not quite sure, because they are all, like you say, they're going after the same audiences.
Yeah.
You know, that's not counter-programming necessarily. Even Barbie and Oppenheimer, it's not counter-programming, because Barbie's not a straight-up kids movie. It's more satire aimed at adults.
And a lot of the audience excited for Mission is the same audience that's excited for Oppenheimer.
Yes, 100%.
Do we know? Because Mission has always been known to be a series that doesn't open huge, opens in the ballpark of 60, but it has legs. Like, that's always been Mission's appeals, that it doesn't have to be a massive, insane, record-breaking opening, because it'll make its money in the weeks to come. But if in the weeks to come, you've got Barbie and Oppenheimer and potentially Indy still chugging along, if it's, I'm more concerned about the weeks to come on Mission than I am the opening. Now, I do think that's why they bumped it up a few days to the 12th.
Wednesday?
Yeah, to Wednesday. Because I think they're less concerned with what those, that 3-day opening is, and they'll report it as the 5-day opening.
Does Mission have a different rollout internationally? Does it open a little bit later in some of the other markets, I wonder?
I bet Gabe knows the answer to that question in approximately 90 seconds.
I'll look.
All right, while he's looking into that, do we want to guess Spider-Verse projections?
I'm going to guess an even 100. I feel like that's a nice, sweet number. And I even guessing that makes me feel like I'm underestimating it a little bit. I hope that it's 115 or higher. Hell, I hope it is very high.
You know what? It's not a 3-day weekend.
What do you mean?
A 4-day weekend. A 4-day weekend. It's not a holiday. Like, if it would have been Memorial Day, I would have said 100 million easily.
Sure.
But Kev, what do you think?
I'm going to say 125.
Hey. Let me get my prediction. I'm going to split the difference between you two and go with 115 million for Across the Spider-Verse. So Jake has 100 million, Kev 125. I'm at 115. Well, we shall see. We have plenty of box office numbers to track as the summer movie season rolls along. Let's get to this week in movies, where we have a couple of exciting things to talk about, including a new horror film called The Boogeyman. And if you listen to Real Blend on the regular, you will know that we had director Rob Savage come on the show. So here's our plug. To go back and find that. We ran it last week because we knew we had so much Spider-Verse stuff to come to. And Rob is a really good interview. He's a young guy who seems like he knows a ton about the movie industry. A lot of great references to old films that were influential in terms of him making this. I went through that entire movie without realizing that the girl who was the older sister in it is the girl from Yellow Jackets, who is the Juliette Lewis stand-in for it. I don't know if she just looks different, but I never once picked up on it. And then somebody was like, "Oh, Sophie Thatcher from Yellow Jackets," and I was like, "What? That was her."
The second season. I've heard the second season's fantastic.
It is very good. Yes, I like it a lot. It's still extremely twisted, and I don't know where that show is going, but I'm kind of on board and willing to watch it. I'll go with Boogeyman and I'll talk about the fact that I thought it was disappointing. Because it was getting the kind of hype that like a Barbarian got last year of like, hey, this is an under the radar gem from a director you're probably not familiar with, and man, it's gonna scare your pants off. And I didn't find it, my biggest knock on is that I never found it scary, really. I wanted to know a little bit about the lore of this boogeyman character, which is essentially a creature that I think feeds on grief and is able to. It's not like haunting a location. It has the ability to move from person to person. And there's two different main families that it follows who have had tragedies in their lives. And I will leave those for you to discover if you should like to. But I haven't seen some of the more recent things like Evil Dead Rises, and so I don't know what to compare it to. But, you know, I was looking for a really good sort of get underneath your skin, even a safe jump scare every once in a while. And I kind of found this one to just be mediocre. And I don't know if you guys are higher on it than I am or not. Jake, you're a resident horror guy. Where'd you fall on it?
I thought it was fine. It kind of reminded me of a better than average version of something that would have come out around 2003, 2004, 2005, including there was one called Boogeyman, which I believe came out around that time. You know, I thought that there were some really interesting imagery and some really interesting moments that showed sort of the flashes of genius from Rob Savage that I feel like we saw a lot of with Host, particularly involving a young girl in a glowing orb that she rolls under the bed. It's in the trailer, but I thought that was a really great moment. A handful of moments like that, one with a flashing red light involving a therapist in mm-hmm. a room. So there are those moments where I was like, yes, like, okay, you're almost there. Like, give me a handful more moments like that. But unfortunately, for every one of those flashes of brilliance, I felt like we were then bogged under another 20 minutes of like not much going on. You also have to keep in mind, it's based on a short story that is essentially the story can be told in one scene in the film. Like one scene in the movie is the short story. So there's not a lot of source material there to go off of. Whenever it says based on the short story by Stephen King, it's not based on the short story like by Stephen King in the way that Stand By Me was based on The Body or Shawshank was based on Shawshank or The Mist was based on The Mist. It's really just literally the entire short story is one room, two people talking in one room. So, it was stretched thin to say the least. I did appreciate seeing, you know, less of the monster and, you know, it as happens in these sort of situations, the more and more we saw it, the less and less scary I found it to be. I walked away thinking it was fine. It doesn't make me think less of Rob Savage, but as Kevin often says, necessity is the mother of invention, and maybe he's a director that thrives under not having as many resources as he was clearly given to make this one.
Because you liked Host. The movie that he directed
it was on my top 10. Honestly, it's one of the all time scariest films I've ever seen in my entire life.
Interesting.
Did you see? I don't think this was an art interview. I think this was a separate Q&A thing, but sometimes they blur the story about the glowing orb.
Mm-mm.
Jake,
no.
And what it was originally supposed to be.
No,
it was originally she was going to have a lightsaber that was glowing, and then Disney was like, she played Leia in our Star Wars series, we need to change that. And so it was like 2 weeks before they had to rewrite a lot of the scares to this ball. I don't think it was ours, maybe it was our CB interview. I forget where he was saying. He's probably saying it all over the place. But a hilarious coincidence that they cast
that's wild
young and Princess Leia
because it's a Disney film. It's
a Disney film, Disney, and they also were like, let's not cross.
That's fantastic.
Have imagery of young Princess Leia with a toy lightsaber, you know, in a major movie.
Kev, how about you? Where'd you fall?
Yeah, I wasn't a huge, massive fan of this one. I found the scares and the storyline to just be very familiar. It didn't do anything new for the genre, at least in my opinion. There were some cool shots, some interesting ways to use lighting. I thought that the Sawyer character was fascinating in the way that light up ball was used to light room and use it. It was a clever way to play with that. And it did bring me back to the concept of, you know, being scared as a kid, checking under my bed, all those things played in. There was just dialogue in this film that I found to be, it's weird because I'm not trying to sit here and be nitpicky about realism because we're dealing with a movie about the boogeyman, but there's a grounded nature I find in horror films sometimes that even in the supernatural aspect of things, like there has to be a level, in my opinion, of realism with the dialogue. Like when I watch The Shining, I know that can't happen, but I also know that the way
people
The Shining
have to behave the way people would behave in that situation.
Right.
I agree with you. I hate whenever people are like, well, dude, it's a movie about monsters. It's like, okay, sure. But right. people still need to behave like humans. Like that's what right. makes these fantastical situations. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I agree 100%.
That's why I like, you know, like films like Sinister, films that generally deal with horrific supernatural situations. What makes them really interesting is when the grounded aspect of the realism of the dialogue and the family and the drama that lead into it. The dialogue in this film, just some of it made me laugh. Some of it took me out of the movie, whether it was intentional or not. I also found, I just found the film not to be memorable. Like it just didn't do anything new. Like with Smile and The Black Phone, these were all films that while they had familiar things with them, they were still doing new things that made me, that scared me in a way that I hadn't seen in horror
right,
before.
Even
like Evil Dead Rise, even though it's like the fifth Evil Dead film or whatever that would be, it still pushed the limits. It still found ways to terrify me, and relentless, brutal horror does that really well. After seeing Evil Dead Rise and then seeing this, it did feel like I was watching like a more of a kid friendly horror movie, which is, you know, again, I have no problem with PG-13. Some of the scariest movies I've ever seen are PG-13. The Sixth Sense is one of the scariest movies I've ever seen. That's PG-13. You can do PG-13 horror. It works. I mean, Poltergeist is PG. Jaws, if you consider it a horror movie, is PG. I mean, there's lots of movies that have dealt with ratings. It's nothing to do with the PG-13 because you can get around that. I mean, The Dark Knight,
well,
for example.
Just on, memorable sequences. Like I think that there are better horror sequences in something like The Pope's Exorcist.
Right.
Like, I remember some of those scenes now, still to this day. But if you asked me specific things that happened in this film, I can't come up with any, to be honest with you. I think you're right when you called it forgettable and just sort of like not very memorable.
It's just something like, I will say, like, there's a really cool sequence in the beginning that I thought was interesting. And I thought David Dasmachian's character had promise, and there's, I won't go into specific details, but there's just a lot of things, the way Jake,
the therapy room.
Yeah.
That's a short story.
Jake described the short story to me, which apparently, I'm sorry if you already said this, but that to me sounds way more interesting than when Jake explained that to me, I said to myself, why isn't that the movie? And I think one of the things that they may have underestimated here is, and again, I don't know the exact decision making process of what happened behind the scenes. I think they made it PG-13 because the story is about kids and they're being scared of under their bed. So they wanted to hit a broader audience. But you look at the box office numbers for Smile and Evil Dead Rise and The Black Phone, which all made over $100 million. I don't think this will make over $100 million. And because one, I don't find it to be as scary or as original. And two, I think an R rating in horror actually makes it more appealing nowadays. And I think while growing up, PG-13,
I think that's the audience that's buying the tickets.
True. And but Smile, for example, I went and saw Smile on a Thursday afternoon. It was all high school kids, you know, in the movies. And because think about it, when you were growing up, R-rated was way more appealing. There was something about, like, it made it like taboo,
and
or like,
oh, and also like we're serious now. We're like, we're being taken seriously as a horror audience, and the movie is taking itself seriously.
You're about to see some stuff. Like, you're about to see some scary stuff. So I actually think weirdly the PG-13 works against it in this movie in a weird way. And is it our show or one of the TV interviews that I did where he said the movie was PG-13 or was going to be R?
It was our
show. He told us
right
that.
before he started filming.
It was originally R up until 2 weeks before they started filming. That's right. He was on our show saying that.
Here's the thing, though.
Tells you something.
But he said they didn't change much. He said they didn't have to change much.
Yeah, this is the kind of project where I'm not sure the rating was going to help it one way or the other. It's just not weird enough. Like, I like weird horror. This is the safest horror you could ever imagine. You know, like even the crystal ball element, which is a fun bit visually, like who hasn't seen that, you know, a bazillion times? To, you know, come back to a cliche that we're using on the show often, like, it's just not memorable. It's not original. And it's I don't know. I feel bad kicking this guy around because he seemed really nice on the show.
He was a great interview. I do recommend
he was a very yeah. good interview. And, you know, King adaptations have their highs and their lows, their peaks and their valleys.
King works. I mean, the dude's been writing for over half because he wrote this story back in 1973. So like he wrote the story 50 years ago. So he's been writing for more than half a century. And Sean, you've read enough Stephen King stuff to know that the man's got a very high ceiling, but also a very low floor.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You know, so the fact, so like middle tier Stephen King, which I think this is fine. Like it's you know, it's not, you know, it's not Salem's Lot. It's not Pet Sematary, but it's also, you know, it's not Dreamcatcher.
Yeah. Exactly. And the last thing I'll say about it is this. The last thing I'll say about it is this. There is some interesting filmmaking in this film. And I do think that Rob Savage it will have a good career. I don't think that this was a film that just it didn't scare me or give memories enough for me to walk away from it and go, yeah, you should go see that.
I wonder how his brother, Randy Savage, the wrestler, is doing.
It's a great question. I was wondering the same thing. I don't know why we didn't ask that.
Maybe next time we get him on. All right, let's throw it to a quick break. And on the other side, the other side, we're going to dive into Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. All right, but the big movie that everybody is going to want to go see in the theaters this week is Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, which we've been talking about a lot already this week and will continue to next week. We'll remind you guys, the next week's episode is going to have the three main directors behind the show, and we're going to save our spoiler conversation talk for next week's episode following their interview because we allowed them to speak openly about spoilers and get into specifics about different scenes. And so we're going to save all of our conversation about that for next week. So this is just our gut reaction to Spider-Man. And I'm going to let Jake go first because I think he's tipped his hand a bit in the commercials that you might have seen making the rounds of how he feels about this latest animated feature.
Imagine he goes, you know, after some thought.
Yeah. Not a fan, to be honest with you.
Jake, you're pretty high on it.
Yeah, I'm very high on it. You know, I remember when we all got out of Avengers Endgame and all texted each other. And I remember getting a text from Sean where I think you said something along the lines of that's one of the greatest films I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking like, damn, like I was really disappointed that you know, I famously did not feel that way about that movie. And I often wonder like, man, when was the last time I walked out of a movie theater thinking that's one of the best movies I've ever seen in my life? And now I can answer that question because I think this is it. I don't want to say the word overwhelmed because there's a negative connotation that comes with that word, but like I just found myself just kind of overwhelmed with the genius and the artistry of that movie. The emotions that I felt, I would put toe to toe with the hardest, strongest emotions I've ever felt in a Pixar movie. I think it is probably the most visually jaw-dropping, awe-inspiring animation I've ever seen in my life. Like it is pushed to me the boundaries of what animation can be and what animation can do. Sean, you said it perfectly that there isn't a moment or a frame that you could not, pause, frame, hang above your fireplace or make the background of your laptop or the wallpaper of your phone. It's just, and it tackles so many interesting themes. And one of the things that we all talked about, I mean, how serious an adult of a film it is. And I think it really emphasizes that point that Guillermo del Toro was driving home the whole award season for Pinocchio, which is that like animation is cinema, like it's not for kids. And I think that this movie touches on a lot of themes of what it feels like to be made to feel like a mistake, to be made to feel like you don't belong in a place that you so desperately want to belong to. You know, that's has to me always been one of the great appeals of Spider-Man is that while it is this big fantastical fantasy of a boy swinging through the skies in New York after being bitten by a spider, it should make at the end of the day, a good Spider-Man story should make you feel like short of being bit by a spider, that could be you. And I feel like this did the best job of doing that.
Right.
So I'm just in awe of that. And just without getting into spoilers, I loved the concept of canon being a plot point. Mm-hmm. It was one of those moments that I've never really thought about being utilized in a movie the way it was. And whenever it was brought up, I just went, you son of a bitch. Like, how has no one really brought up the idea of canon And because it's a word that we all use so casually when describing everything, describing Star Wars or whatever the case may be. But making it a plot point, I thought was genius. So absolutely brilliant screenplay. Gorgeous, flawless animation. Like, I genuinely, truly believe it's my favorite animated movie of all time. I wish I could put it on. Like, I asked my rep. I was like, I know this is stupid, and I know the answer is no, and I know you're gonna laugh at me, but can I get a link? Because I really just want to watch it over and over and over again. I really just want to put it on my TV. And I was like, I've seen it. I'm not gonna give it to anybody. And she's like, and of course, the answer was no. But I just can't. And I loved the first one. The first one was on my top 10 list at the end of the year. Loved the first one. But as Sean beautifully put it when we all got out of the movie, this one makes the first one look like stick figures.
And really I feel does. Bad saying that because but even going back and watching clips of the first one, like, I'm still like, oh, this looks incredible. The Into the Spider-Verse still looks incredible for what it was doing for animation at that time, which is 5 years ago, which is a lifetime in terms of animation improving and the tools coming at it. But it's not even just that. It's just their approach. It's their approach to animation and the way that they use color schemes inside of scenes to reflect emotions and how each of the different multiverses that you either travel into or just even peek into will have such a distinct look, and it's not too dissimilar to if you read a character over the course of, you know, multiple issues in a title, you'll get different artists who come in and out. And sometimes it can be really jarring when you've been reading, you know, or enjoying the ink done by one artist for 10 issues, and then they shift to another person for 2 issues, and you might not like the style quite as much, right? And you're just like, ah, I still love this character, but I don't really love the way it's looking on screen. But I freaking loved every single thing that we saw in Spider-Verse. And that's why I think that the Spot was such a terrific villain as a way to sort of create a portal, you know what I mean, into these other universes. I also just thought he was really funny. I thought Jason Schwartzman was terrific in terms of his delivery. I thought the entire cast was great in terms of their delivery. Oscar Isaac gets some really great lines. Shameik Moore is still great. Haley Steinfeld still great. Jake Johnson gets less to do in this one. He's not quite the full mentor character, but the stuff with Miles's parents I thought was fantastic. There's some really, really, really beautiful elements in here of a parent having to accept the fact that your kid is getting older and moving on. And I think that they touch that stuff beautifully. Kevin brought it up. I think you brought up with Lord and Miller about the line from the mom of like, there's a little boy inside of you who is always going to be this little boy. And you know, I have a 19 year old and a 15 year old, and I still call them like our baby, like Brendan's baby boy. And PJ's, you know, little boy, and they're always good. That's how I will see them for the rest of my life. And so, you know, these things just hit home in a way. But like, in addition to that, the action is remarkable. It moves with the physicality and the physics that you can do with Spider-Man only in animation. And I think because of animation and because of the way that they're able to sort of rapidly transition between the different multiverses, this one movie has done more to further the concept of multiverse storytelling than anything being done by Marvel or DC in live action. And I can't fault those guys because live action multiverse is just really difficult. You have to get John Krasinski to agree to play Reed Richards, you know, for a couple of scenes in Doctor Strange, or you need Keaton to commit to the bit.
Yeah, I want to push back on that concept a little bit whenever people say, well, it's so much easier to do in animation that it is in live action.
Right.
I get the concept of, yeah, it's harder to get different actors to, but like when 90% of these Marvel movies these days are shot in front of a green screen and so much of it is CGI, isn't that just a different form of animation? Like, is it that much harder to do it in short of, yeah, it's tough to get Michael Keaton back. So like, yeah, I get the whole concept of like bringing back that, you know, but in terms of just representing the multiverse. I mean, that was always my biggest knock about Doctor Strange was that like the craziest thing they could come up with is that you cross the street on green and you stop. Like that was like the mind went nuts. And that was a crazy, like, I'm sorry. Like that's, it's not that much harder when so much of these live action movies are CGI. It's just a different style of animation. They just don't have as good of ideas as Phil Lord and Chris Miller did.
And I think I think it's people sort of being a bit reductive by saying that, because I think what they're trying to say, or what they mean, is that live action is handcuffed to realism. And if you're off by 10% from realism, you get criticized for not looking real.
Okay, Whereas, that's fair.
It's not about easier, because I think sure. it's reducing animation down to like, oh, you just throw some splashy color. Like,
sure.
I think it's taking away from the art form, especially of something like a Spider-Verse. But I think what they're getting at the core is being handcuffed to realism and how you have to nail it or you don't.
That's
versus
fair.
Living in a style.
Can I give one quick example? And sure. This is something that everybody has seen in the trailers. It's not giving anything away. But there's a moment where Miles steps into what is the lobby of the multiverse, and you're able to see, let's say, roughly 50 to 75 different Spider-Men, you know, who are costumed in incredibly different ways, right? Try to recreate that exact scene in live action, and you need extras and costumes, and you need, you know, this is all stuff that like costs a lot of money and takes a lot of time.
In true Marvel fashion, all of those Spider-Men would be CGI.
True. Okay. All right. I see your point.
But now, I also get Gabe's point about it needing to be hand, because there are moments in this film where, you know, this character from this multiverse is in the same scene as this character from this multiverse. And because it's animation, their animation styles can look completely different.
Sure.
And our brain accepts it, to Gabe's point, because it's animation. So, yes, I do agree with that. But I also would like to remind you that, you know, they don't even shoot Spider-Man movies in New York anymore. So it's all CGI. It's all CGI. It's all some form of computer animation.
Jake, did you know they shot Batman in Chicago? Did you know that, Jake?
No, I live in Gotham City.
Oh, sorry.
Jake is Batman, by the way.
Just significantly less money.
So my opinion is that it is the best Spider-Man movie ever made. Jake, are you saying that as well, too?
100%. It is my favorite Spider-Man movie ever.
Kevin, your favorite?
And then Sam Raimi, Spider-Man 2.
Kev, your favorite of all time, or?
Third favorite.
Third favorite. Okay, interesting. Yep. So where do you fall on it?
I mean, it's a masterpiece. It's one of the best superhero films I've ever seen. I do want to, and this might be controversial, I do want to mention this. It is a film that is a first part of a story. I want people to understand this. And Phil and Chris talked about it in the interview. I get that the movie's called Across the Spider-Verse. The next one's called Beyond the Spider-Verse. From what I understand, originally it was a part one, part two. As I sat in the theater, did not know that the film was going to end where it ended. For me, it feels like it is not a finished, complete story. That doesn't take away from the movie itself, because the movie itself is absolutely incredible. But there's a lot of story left to happen that they build up in this story. And it's just, you know, that's the nature of how films work when you make them, you know, you make them in order. You go, you have the first part, second part, third part, Lord of the Rings part, you know, Fellowship of the Ring, Two Towers, and Return of the King. It happens all the time. I think that going into this film, I did not know or remember or have enough knowledge of that this was going to be, in my opinion, half a story. And I don't know if you guys agree with me on that. That's what it feels like. In terms of the film itself, looking at this film as itself, it is incredible on every level. Visually, the sound design is absurd. And Pemberton, when you hear our Daniel Pemberton interview, you're going to hear a lot of how his score work is all part of the sound design as well. Little things you're hearing in the film that you might not think of as music are coming from him and his ideas. Obviously, there's sound effects and sound design that is being done as well, but that's all married together. The way Pemberton's score works with the soundtrack is incredible. There's a way the film moves and breathes musically that I find beautiful. And the beginning of the film is literally, you know, a drumming sequence, as we were talking about earlier, right, Sean? It's, you know, mm-hmm. the band sequence. So I want to point out a few things that I think are really strong in this movie. The voice performances from everybody involved are outstanding. The one that I can't stop thinking about is Oscar Isaac. Mm. I thought Oscar 100%. Isaac's performance in this film was one of his best performances of his career. It's a great performance. It's a great character. This character is Miguel O'Hara. The character has such a weight to him emotionally and kind of, in my opinion, grounds the whole film. I really think that his character is the centerpiece, the grounding. And because Miles character is so amazing. He's obviously the lead, and Shameik Moore is brilliant, but he's a kid. You know, he's a kid in high school. So he is dealing with all of these things, quote unquote, saving the world, the multiverse, but also I'm grounded by my parents because I haven't been going to class kind of thing. And so he's just it's so all over the place. But that's the point of it. That's what would happen for a teenager to be given this information and have this weight of the world on their shoulders. For me, the Oscar Isaac character kind of is the reality point of it. He understands the scope of everything. He understands the emotions of what Miles is dealing with. And Miles does not fully understand what he's dealing with. That's kind of the whole concept of the movie, in my opinion. And so I got to give Oscar Isaac credit because his performance is unbelievable. It's amazing. Hailee Steinfeld and Shameik Moore are outstanding. Incredible chemistry, incredible sequences, beautiful voice work. I know we got to move on, but I love this movie from visual to emotions to score music. When I say it's my third favorite, I always Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 2 is my ultimate. It just will always be. I know this is going to be a hot take. I love Far From Home. I'm sorry. I just do. I'm obsessed with Far From Home.
Far From Home?
Far From Home is my second favorite Spider-Man movie.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Because, and the reason, and I don't care, and people can give me crap for that. What I loved about Spider-Man Far From Home was the filmmaking vibe of it. I mean, essentially, Jake Gyllenhaal's character is a filmmaker. And that just kind of struck me in a very interesting way. This is my number three Spider-Man film of all time. And I'm talking about, they're following two of my favorite Spider-Man movies of ever. And this is definitely right there. I love this movie. It is outstanding. The word masterpiece gets thrown around a lot. It is a masterpiece. But I just want to warn people. This is, in my opinion, it's a half a movie.
OK, we will debate this next week when more people have seen
it. Yes. But Jake and Sean, you guys, I'm not that far off. It's not a full movie. It's not.
I disagree.
I think this is probably perfect for our spoiler discussion that we have next week.
This episode is all things Spider-Man, which I will never complain about. But the blend game is going to be hashtag Spidey blend. And from that perspective, we are doing favorite moments from a Spider-Man movie. And that can include Into the Spider-Verse or even Across the Spider-Verse if you want it to. Jake Hamilton, what is your all time favorite moment from one of the Spider-Man movies?
I'm curious to if anyone has the same one as me. Mine is Mr. Stark, I Don't Feel So Good.
That's Infinity War, though.
Yeah, Infinity War. It's not from Spider-Man, but it's still a Spider-Man moment. Still a Spider-Man moment. The thing I always love, I was just saying, what I love about Spider-Man is at the end of the day, he's bit by a radioactive spider. He's taking on these wild, crazy, insane villains, and there's symbiotes, and there's this and this and this. At the end of the day, he is a kid in high school. Mm-hmm. And that is what makes Spider-Man such a great character, is that at the end of the day, he's brave, but he still gets scared. He will sacrifice anything to save people, but he still has a crush on the girl in class. Like, he's still a kid. And that moment when he is like being this big, brave superhero, but all of a sudden he realizes he's about to die and he's going to his hero, who has kind of been this father figure of him, and him sort of like in a brilliant performance by Tom Holland saying, I don't want to go. I don't want to go. I don't want to go. Like as I'm getting chills talking, literally getting chills talking about, as Tony Stark is like trying to like helplessly trying to save him. This kid who like he kind of was trying to protect. He wanted to give everything to protect from a moment like this as he's turning to dust. And keep in mind, they don't know that this is happening everywhere else in the universe at the same time. They don't really understand this moment. All he knows is that this kid who trusted him with everything is dying and he's scared and there's nothing he can do about it.
And Tony's very first line when he steps off the ship in Avengers Endgame and he says to Cap, the very first thing he says to him was, I lost the kid.
Lost the kid.
Yeah. Yep.
And I think the tragedy of that moment.
Chills by you saying that, Sean. Right. I just want you to know. Yeah. Like, I started to well up. I was right? like, oh yeah, that really does hit. Like,
that's
oh.
the tragedy yeah. of that moment. Tom Holland's brilliant performance in that moment. To me, those emotions don't work unless they reinforce what the character of Spider-Man is about. Mm-hmm. And the reason that character works is because it reminded us, holy shit, he's a kid. And yep. that's why I love that moment.
Beautiful. Kev, where'd you go?
It's funny. There's a lot of them. But the one that I think about the most emotionally is in Homecoming when he's in the car with Keaton.
Oh, great choice. Great choice.
Great choice. Blew my mind.
Look at Tom Holland getting all the picks.
Man, I it's so funny because I don't necessarily love Homecoming, but that's probably the scene that I remember just my jaw dropping.
It's a really great twist that most people still claim they didn't see coming.
I remember because I didn't do the junket, so I saw it opening night. I remember being in that opening night. It might have been a Thursday night, audience packed. And I remember like that the audible collective body of the audience kind yeah. of like the air just being sucked out of the room.
And it's so obvious too.
Oh, but it's so obvious when you that I felt it was one of those things. I was like, am I stupid for not seeing that coming? Yeah.
I know that was so.
But I love that I didn't see it coming. Like, I love like I'm not good at figuring out twists in advance, mm-hmm. Which I take as a positive for someone who does what I do. But I just was just blown away. Kevin, that's a great pick.
When he said, I see dead people, Jake went, what does he mean by that?
define dead. What is this movie?
Yeah.
What are they? Wait, did I need to see the first two fifth senses to understand what's going on? Yeah.
I have three. I'm going to rattle through
no,
really quickly.
One. You get one.
I did not choose.
We
ought
to hold a book about this, Sean. Pick one.
I did not choose him being buried underneath the rubble in Homecoming, which is a terrific scene.
It's a great one. Doesn't he scream help?
Yes, he does.
Isn't that a frame ripped right from one of the comics?
So it's Amazing Spider-Man 33. It's called The Final Chapter. And he's buried underneath this rubble and he has to get to this serum in order to save Aunt May, who is dying. And he has to come up with the willpower and the strength to lift this thing up off of him, this impossible weight. And it goes to show that Spider-Man just cannot quit. He's not allowed to quit, essentially. And when that happened, when that moment happened in Homecoming, I was in New York attending the junket, and he was buried underneath the rubble, and you could see the way he was pinned. And I edged to the edge of my seat and I said, are they going to do this? Are they about to do the final chapter? And then he does it. He gets underneath it and he lifts it. And I was just like in heaven, basically. But I didn't pick that one. I am going with the moment in Spider-Man No Way Home where the three guys get together after getting their asses kicked. And they realize they have to work together as a team, and the whole Peter 1, Peter 2, Peter 3, and then they go running off, and the three of them swing together and land on their majestic Spider-Man poses. And it's fantastic because as they are up in the air and getting ready to land, if you've never noticed this, the poses that they strike while they are in the air with the moon backlighting them are the poses that are available on their DVD covers. That are distinct to each of one to Toby, one to Andrew, and one to Tom. And I just think like that little bit with the chemistry when Holland's like, I don't mean to brag, but I was in the Avengers and they don't know what the Avengers are kind of thing.
Is that a band?
And then, is that a band? Oh my gosh, you in a band? And then Andrew's delivery of Peter 3, I think honestly should have got him a Peter 3. Should have got him an Oscar because it's just outstanding. So I went with that pick. Audience picks. Danny Thill said Peter saving MJ in No Way Home. So that's Garfield's Peter. And Peter telling May he was there with Uncle Ben in Spider-Man 2. Okay, that's a tough one. Damian McDonald says the first time I saw him on the big screen in Spider-Man 2002, I was in awe. Jose Munez says No Way Homes. Is that a band? Are you in a band? Moment of confusion from Garfield's Peter Parker. Zen Jake says Miles becoming Spider-Man and his leap from the building and into the Spider-Verse.
What's up, Danger?
Tremendous.
I thought about What's Up, Danger.
It's a great one. And my favorite part about that moment is that that's when Miles gets his comic book. His comic book lands on top of the pile and he's officially a Spider-Man. Yeah. Oh, God.
Sean, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Who's your favorite Aunt May?
Rosemary Harris.
Me too.
Yeah.
Why is that? Why is she our favorite?
Because she's the closest to comic book adaptation. I don't mind Sally Field. I don't think Sally Field got used the right way, but mm-hmm. Sally Field and Martin. Who?
Martin Sheen.
Sheen, thank you. Were a good pair, but she's not a good Aunt May. Rosemary Harris was just the perfect amount of a old, delicate Aunt May. And then Tomei, I don't know what Tomei is doing. I don't know, or was doing, I guess, at this point. And David Hammer says, my favorite Spider-Man moment after a lot of contemplation is when Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man stops Tom's Spider-Man from killing Green Goblin in No Way Home. It was just such a powerful moment, and I thought it was great that Tobey got to be the real hero of that moment. So,
ooh, can I pick one more?
Sure.
When Tobey and Alfred Molina are reunited in No Way Home.
Ah, that's a good one too.
And he says, "You know, how you been?" And he goes, "I'm trying to be better.
Trying to do better."
Mm-hmm. And, just the way, and it shows how good of an actor Alfred Molina is that he's able to snap back into it. But the way that he snaps back into how Otto Octavius spoke to Peter before he became Doc Ock, like that very mm-hmm. gentle, almost father-like. Like, I think he even calls him my boy, like, how are you, my boy, or something like that.
Yep.
I loved
that is moment. One of my favorite scenes from Spider-Man 2 is when the two of them are sitting around just discussing mm-hmm. science, you know, once, because first he's annoyed to have to sit with Peter because Harry mm-hmm. Osborn sort of pulls strings to get him to sit down for this lunch. And then Otto realizes how smart Peter is, and then he introduces him to Rosie. Dude, I have shit to do this afternoon.
You're making me want to sit down and rewatch all these Spider-Man movies.
Hey, listen, I've lived with them for years upon years. So thank you, everybody, who participated in Spidey Blend this week.
Great picks.
For next week, Gabe, we have some changes to get into.
This is what we were teasing earlier in the show. So I've got some update news, big update news, but not, you know, let's not get too crazy. It's a little bittersweet. Ultimately, is exciting, I think, because the four of us are all very excited about what this means. But for next week's blend game, we are not having a blend game. And that is because moving forward, starting next week, we are going to shift the format of the show a little bit. It's still going to feel like the show. The show is not changing in the sense that we're going to be doing anything terribly different, particularly the way that we present ourselves and talk about things, because I don't think we could ever help that. But a lot of these updates are all looking at streamlining the show a little bit, spending more time on segments that we're more passionate about, and introducing some more fun, exciting segments into the mix. So I'm going to give sort of a blanket update of sort of where that's headed. And then I'd love to hear your guys' feedback if you want to email me, realblend@cinemablend.com. But one of those things is we're no longer going to do the blend game in the show. But there may be a version of that can still live on social. Write in if it's something you guys still want to keep doing. And that's going to just give us more time to do other things and to, you know, spend more time in our reviews, do more spoiler segments and things like that. The other big thing that is happening is that Monday's premium episode is going to be our last premium episode. We're recording it right after this, and we're going to try to make it extra special for everyone who subscribes to that and pays for that. I'm going to do this sort of chat a little bit again at the start of that episode in case you're missing this now. But just letting you know that is happening. So we're no longer going to do the premium segment. We're no longer going to do things like the blend game. And then starting next week, you'll see a bit of a change in the way that we format the show after our interviews. But all of this is in support of having more fun on the show, doing more of what we do on the premium in our show. And none of it is going to change the way that we do interviews necessarily. And hopefully is all going to help support doing bigger, better interviews. I do want to quickly say here, I'll say more in the premium feed, but if you pay for premium, we're still going to offer it. It's still going to be $5 a month. You're still going to get a newsletter and you're still going to get an ad-free version of the show. We're just not going to have that extra segment. If you want to cancel that because you were in for the extra segment, totally understand. No hard feelings. You're still a real one and that won't change. That's just the price itself is not going to change, even though we are technically giving you less, just because that's as low as we can justify it, for the ad-free, which is the main benefit of that. So that is the rigmarole. I don't think I've forgotten anything, guys. If you guys want to say your two cents about, I know you guys have been excited about some of the plans that we have, some of the ideas that we have, and just the idea of, being a little bit more relaxed after our interviews and doing some fun stuff, getting some more behind the scenes, you know.
Well, you know, I think, you know, for the four of us hopped on a call to give you a little bit of behind the scenes in terms of what was going on, just to kind of discuss what was going on with the show. And one of the really interesting things that I was thinking in my head as the discussion was happening that everyone individually brought up to kind of show that we were all on the same page is for anyone who is listening that subscribes to Premium, there are so many moments that we would get done recording a Premium episode and just keep laughing at a joke that was made, or just kind of within the days to come, talk about something that happened at Premium that we just couldn't let go of, that was so fun or that we got so passionate about it. And, you know, I think we all sort of agree that that's kind of what the show should be, that passion and that sort of off the cuff enthusiasm should be there. And so I really do think I think we have a really passionate fan base of people that like sort of that unstructured madness of the Premium episode. And to some degree, I would say, obviously, it's not going to be a copy paste, but I think a lot of the vibe of that, the freedom of that, is going to be brought over. So I would argue, Gabe, and you correct me if I'm wrong, a little bit less structure, a little bit more chaos, but all still
good mix.
Good mix of the two.
I think split a good way to think about it. And you know, over the course of the next few weeks, as we're putting those shows together, I want to hear your guys' feedback about things that we introduce that you like or don't like. I think the biggest change that you'll see is sort of trying to hit everything that's coming out this week. You know, if you're listening this long and you're interested in this behind the scenes stuff that I'm going way too more in detail than you need, rather than us trying to be, you know, a one-stop shop for like, here's everything coming this week and here are our thoughts on everything, focus more on the things that we're actually passionate about and spend more time with those things that you're passionate about at home too. You know, keep writing in and saying, I want to hear you guys talk about this, because that'll motivate us to talk about it or to check it out. You know, I don't want anyone at home to think that we're cutting out the audience in the participation. We're hoping to get more of that. We're hoping to sort of foster more of that. So it should be fun.
I also want to emphasize that I held out for more speaking parts. And a larger trailer as well too backstage. So
how'd that work out for you?
Not too great.
Not too great. Yeah. So that's pretty much it. I think we're all excited. Sorry, Kevin, if you wanted to add more. I know you're excited.
You guys
about
said
it as well.
You guys said everything. Yeah, you guys are great. It was great.
But yeah, appreciate you guys as always at home. I think this is gonna be really fun. I think, as you know, things are picking up with the summer, it's gonna give us a lot of really cool opportunities to do stuff a little differently. Again, the reason we kept this at the end is because, you know, this feels like a big announcement, and maybe some of you are really upset about the Blend game and the Premium stuff. And I want to hear your feedback, of course. But hopefully give us some time. If you feel upset, I don't think anyone's going to feel upset, but if something made you upset, give us time to, you know, put a few more of these out. So you see that, you know, we're still Real Blend. We're still going to, still going to feel like us, and more so probably, than before with what we're going to do. So. Thank you all for listening. More personal stories as well.
Stories from the road and more insights into the
cool
things.
There's one this month that could be really cool. I don't want to keep hyping up because...
Two this month.
Oh, that's true. Two this month. There's some fun stories to be had coming up.
We shall see. All right, anyway.
Yeah.
On to that. So one more Premium episode. It's going to be a Spider-Man focused IMDb game. So check the description below for how you can... tune in for that, essentially. And in the meantime, we'll be back next week at Jake's Takes. Wait, I got to give the media socials at Kev McCarthy TV, at Gabe Kovach, at Sean_O'Connell. And the show is at Cinema Blend. Until then.
Oppenheimer.
Thank you, Kevin. There we go.
Larry Crown.
Barbie.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.